customs, clothes, handcrafts, music, and foods. The beautiful clothes of Turkmens and their handmade ornaments attract every viewer. Turkmen music is also unique. The main musical instrument of Turkmens is called tamdire, which looks like the smallest type of dotar. Turkmens are Sunni Muslims who respect God's bounties and pay high respect for foods, especially bread. They sit on the ground around a tablecloth and say Bismillah, or in the name of God, before starting the food. At the end of the food also, the elderly, usually the father, recites verses of the Quran and thanks God, while others say Amen. Some of the most famous Turkmen foods are çektirme, katlama, börek, çörek, pişme, and susme. Stay tuned to get familiar with çektirme. Çektirme is a very popular Turkmen food which is made during parties, wedding and mourning ceremonies. It has also attracted travelers and tourists. It can be prepared with meat or fish. In continuation of this episode, you will hear on çektirme with meat. The following are ingredients for making çektirme for three people. 3 measures of rice, 350 grams of fresh ground meat, 250 grams of grated tomato, a middle-sized onion chopped in very little pieces, 2 spoonfuls of tomato paste, salt, oil, pepper, and special spices as much as needed. Now, if you want to make this çektirme, listen to this recipe. You should have a cast iron or zinc pot. First, wash the rice and soak it for a few hours in lukewarm water and salt. Pour a little oil in the pot and put it on mild fire. Pour onion when the oil is hot and let it be fried a bit. Then add turmeric so that the smell can be felt. Now, pour meat pieces in a pot and let them fry. Then add salt, pepper, and rice spices and stir them well. Then add the grated tomatoes, and once the tomatoes are dry, add tomato paste and fry it. Next, add 2.5 measures of water and let it be cooked on mild flame. This phase usually takes 2 hours. Then add the rice and pour enough water. Now let çektirme be cooked on mild fire. After half an hour, your delicious çektirme is ready. Çektirme is usually served with local yogurt, camel duk. Duk is a mixture of yogurt and water. Shirazi salad, raw garlic or garlic pickles. Dear listeners, the Coast Bazaar of Bandar-e Turkmen or Turkmen Port on Gorgan Gulf is an appropriate place for promenade and buying Turkmen handicrafts and clothes. You can find fast food like börek, susme and pişme too. Bishme is a kind of traditional sweet of Turkmens. To make the sweet, you need 2 glasses of sweet yogurt, 1.5 glasses of milk, 3 glasses of sugar, 2 eggs, 2 spoonfuls of baking powder, 1/4 of teaspoon of vanilla, 3 glasses of flour, and enough oil. And now the recipe. First, stir eggs and sugar and add yogurt and milk. Then add flour, vanilla, and baking powder. To give a better color to the sweets, you can add some saffron. Then leave it in a pretty warm place. 20 minutes later, flatten the dough as thick as 1 joint of finger. Then cut it into little pieces. You can make it in different shapes with different frames. Finally, fry the little pieces of dough. Remember that the dish for this sweet should be deep so that oil covers the dough and the sweets become puffy. Don't forget that the flame should be mild. Make this tasty Turkmen sweet and enjoy it with your family.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
By some accounts, the history of animation stretches back to the turn of the 20th century. However, the art finds its roots in antiquity. A 5,200-year-old vase found in Iran's burnt city in the 1970s features a series of 5 images that researchers have only recently identified as being sequential. Giving it a spin, one would see a goat leaping to snatch leaves from a tree. Fast forward to today, Iranian animations have made significant progress. While the first modern cinematic animations were produced in Iran about a decade ago, thanks to the efforts by Iran's talented youths, the country's animated movies have attracted the attention of a huge number of viewers. The number of high-quality animations has grown compared to previous years in Iran. The new award-winning animated blockbuster Lupetu is a perfect example. The name Lupetu is inspired by a word local people in Kerman province of Iran used to refer to handmade toys that mothers used to make for their children in the past. The animation is about a sanitarium where a doctor treats his mental patients by teaching them to make toys. An unknown culprit vandalizes the creative toy workshop, which is particularly popular among Iranian children, and causes its closure. The doctor's son, Ali, tries to help his father to solve the problem. The process of making the animation took over 3 years. It was ready to be screened in 2020. However, the coronavirus outbreak delayed the screening, and finally, it hit Iran's silver screens from early November 2022. The box office hit is one of the most popular on-screen films of Iranian cinemas right now. It managed to become the most popular movie in Iranian cinemas only within a month and a half of its release in the fall season. Lupetu has also taken part in various national and international festivals. Despite their success, the director of Lupetu says there is no room for complacency, adding, Iranian animation studios should redouble their efforts to keep up with the big names in the industry.
Iran's animation industry is progressing. It's perfect that children can watch this animation in the cinemas. But we have a long way to go. We should produce more high-quality cinematic animations to keep up with foreign animations.
Lupatu's producers say it will soon be screened in other countries, with Turkey and Russia showing interest to screen the animation in their cinemas.
Several high-quality cinematic animations have been made in Iran in recent years, and Lupatu is one of them. The blockbuster animation's success testifies that Iran has made significant progress that puts it on a par with big names in the industry.
In order to avoid paying billions of dollars in fines, it appears that the Pakistani government is attempting to find a solution for the completion of an Iran-Pakistan gas pipeline project. This comes after Pakistani lawmakers demanded progress on the publicly funded project and warned that Pakistan could face its penalty if the pipeline project with Iran is not completed before the year end. The Petroleum Ministry officials warn that Pakistan will have to pay $18 billion as a fine if it terminates Iran-Pakistan gas pipeline agreement. The officials told lawmakers that Islamabad has spoken to the United States to request a waiver as there is a ban on importing gas from Iran. The parliamentarians asked the Pakistani Ministry of Foreign Affairs to summon the American envoy and demand that he either grant Islamabad permission to move forward with the project or provide funding to cover the fine. Washington has been pushing Islamabad to give up the plan to import gas from neighboring Iran. However, the government has so far publicly resisted the pressure, arguing that the project is vital to fulfill the country's energy needs.
We should revive the Iran-Pakistan pipeline. That is the key. And we also demand the lifting of sanctions which have been imposed by certain Western countries against Iran, because the sanctions are wrong. They are unjust and they are immoral. And Iran, like Pakistan, is a peaceful country. They want to strengthen regional relations.
Like the rest of the world, Pakistan is no exception to the global energy crisis, which is worsening each passing day. Experts believe that pending gas pipeline project with Iran could be an immediate remedy to overcome the energy needs in Pakistan if the country manages to get out of the U.S. influence.
Because of the U.S. Importance in foreign relations, Pakistan has always been pressurized by the United States not to increase its trade with Iran and not to negotiate any agreements with Iran. Unfortunately, Pakistan has yielded to that pressure. Pakistan is importing gas from Qatar and other countries, Azerbaijan even, and why not import gas from Iran, which is cheaper than from so many other countries.
In 2009, the gas companies of both Pakistan and Iran signed an agreement under which Islamabad committed to building an 800-kilometer pipeline to the Iranian border by the end of 2014. However, due to the U.S. pressure, Islamabad could not fulfill its commitment. Iran has already finished a portion of the pipeline in its own territory from the gas field to the Pakistan border, where it should connect to the Pakistani part.
The call on the Pakistani government to step up efforts to complete Iran-Pakistan gas pipeline project comes as Islamabad is already grappling with several crises here at home. Avoiding this $18 billion penalty could save the country from falling into another one. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Syrian political parties, along with Syria-based Palestinian factions, have gathered in Arnous Square in Damascus, calling on the U.S. and its Western allies to lift economic sanctions on Syria. Speakers said this Western siege on Syria is inhumane and requires urgent actions by the international community, considering that people in Syria are dealing with deteriorating economic conditions following the recent earthquakes.
We express our anger over the unilateral sanctions imposed by the U.S. and its allies. Syrians suffered a lot as a result of such unjust and inhumane actions. Not lifting them is a crime against humanity. We call on the U.N. to shoulder its responsibilities and try to get such sanctions lifted.
We reiterate our support for Syria and reject the unjust seizure act, which led to shortages in basic needs. We call on the U.S. to stop looting Syria's resources and get out of the Arab country. We also call on Arab and Islamic nations to stand beside Syrians dealing with crises. We call on the Arab League to give Syria a seat back to the country.
Participants raised Syrian and Palestinian flags as well as banners asking for an end to the decades-long bans that have deprived them of their basic needs and resulted in a surge of food and medicine prices.
This is an unjust siege. We as Syrians are suffering from this siege in all aspects of our daily lives, starting from transportation, because the bans have caused a lack of fuel as well as shortage in medicine and also high food prices. All that is because of the imperial blockade.
Life changed so much following the sanctions. Prices went high. People are searching for their basic needs. This siege caused a shortage of so many basic commodities. We call on the world to do something and help us.
The recent earthquakes have further worsened the already deteriorating economic and humanitarian situation in Syria. The UN says even before the earthquake tragedy, 70% of the population needed humanitarian assistance due to the war on the country.
One challenge after another, Syrians endured so many hardships in the past decade that made living a normal life a daily challenge. U.S. and EU sanctions exacerbated their suffering, and they demand an end to such injustice. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, has said that there is, quote, great expectations about his ongoing talks with Iranian officials over issues concerning their cooperation. The remarks sent a positive signal on the course of cooperation between the agency and Tehran. That positive assessment was also echoed by Mohammad Islami, head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization.
The Islamic Republic will in no way compromise on its national interests and its national security. These meetings show Tehran and the IAEA maintain a professional relationship based on trust, and that we attach great importance to abiding by the IAEA safeguards.
Islami added that IAEA reports have confirmed that Iran has not enriched uranium beyond 60% and that issues regarding claims that some uranium particles have been found in undeclared sites in Iran have been resolved. Grossi, for his part, said that the discussions are being held in an atmosphere of honesty and cooperation. Asked to comment on claims that IAEA has adopted a political approach towards Iran, he insisted that the agency is not a political tool for any country.
The IAEA has not been and will never be a political tool of anybody. I, as Director General, I am independent. I am under no country's instructions. And we act in a way that is very transparent. Member states have a board of governors. Every step we take is scrutinized, and I think that what is important is to work together, as the Vice President was saying, work on the cooperation, which is very important, on peaceful uses, work on the observance of the comprehensive safeguard agreements, and all the rest is speculation.
Grossi was also asked by reporters present in the presser to comment on the Israeli regime's total lack of accountability regarding its nuclear weapons program. Grossi said that there are limitations to the agency's inspections of those that have not signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
That being said, let me conclude this important question by saying that every country in the world should be party, should be a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
The visit appears to have helped improve relations between Iran and the IAEA, particularly scientific and technical collaboration between them. The two officials said that Iran's annual nuclear science conference, which has so far been held on a national level, will be upgraded to an international conference from next year.
Both sides have expressed satisfaction with the talks, and Mr. Grossi himself has called the atmosphere positive, which could pave the way for the revival of the nuclear deal. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
Even though inflation remains at a 40-year high, United States President Joe Biden has terminated a program which provided extra food money for over 40 million of the poorest Americans. The elderly, the disabled, students, poor children, and the working poor are now forced to find an average of nearly $100 more every month to spend on food. With sanctions on Russia still massively backfiring across the West, grocery prices here have soared more than 11% over the last year.
The families aren't purchasing food at the same price that they were pre-pandemic. So if not, you know, apart from having families come in more often, we may start seeing families that have to cut back on their housing budget. So what they typically spent on rent, utilities, they may have to start dipping into that to pay for groceries.
Experts on food insecurity contend that food aid to the poor has been insufficient, and that was long before the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program started seeing cuts. The expansion of so-called food stamps was both popular and successful, leading to an immediate 10% reduction in the overall poverty rate and a 14% drop in child poverty.
Versus 2021, when a lot of the pandemic relief was in force, our numbers were actually down significantly. So we've seen our numbers grow from 2021 to 2022, about 40%, give or take. We can only imagine what this next round will bring.
Without government involvement, citizens can only turn to charities for help. In states which have prematurely stopped the expanded food aid, food banks are already reporting a 40% increase in the number of visitors.
Last year, the ruling Democrats voted to end the pandemic's expansion of Medicaid, the federal program which provides a bare minimum of health care for the nation's poor. At the end of this month, at least 15 million people will also lose their health care coverage.
Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
A big rally was held in the blockaded Gaza Strip following the Friday prayers to support Palestinians in the Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank in the face of rising Israeli settlers' aggression against Palestinians. People from all walks of life came out to express their commitment to resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank against Israeli attacks. Tensions have been skyrocketed in the recent days as extremist Israeli settlers under the protection of Israeli regime forces went on a rampage in the occupied West Bank villages, torching dozens of houses and cars. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says the upcoming holy month of Ramadan will witness an increase in resistance against the Israeli regime.
We vow to make the holy month of Ramadan as a month of renewing our commitment to defending Al-Aqsa Mosque and Palestine. The holy month of Ramadan will be a month of mercy and unity among Palestinians, while we turn it into a month of hellfire that will burn the occupiers and the Israeli settlers.
Israeli forces and settlers' attacks since the start of 2023 have claimed the lives of some 70 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and called on all Muslims to support Palestinians and help defend Al-Quds.
We call on our brothers in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank to remain strong and steadfast. We will always support them, and we demand all Muslims and Arabs to support them in the face of settlers' attacks.
Latest figures show that the Israeli settlers' population in the occupied West Bank has grown to more than 500,000 as of January 2020. This is while some 200,000 settlers reside in Al-Quds. The Hamas movement stressed that Palestinians will remain united in the face of all Israeli aggressions.
We are here to support the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds, and we say to the Zionist regime and those who support it that the Palestinian revolution and the resistance will not stop, and will spread to all Palestinian cities. This protest is sending a message of unity against the Zionist regime and the radical right-wing Zionist cabinet that continues to kill and maim Palestinians.
Observers say the international community has failed to help the Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds and turned a blind eye to Israeli violations against them.
Palestinians here are calling for stepping up armed resistance against the Israeli regime in order to foil all plots against Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
With a crippling economy and a local currency losing more than 90% of its value, many of the Lebanese people dealing with economic hardships are hoping that the upcoming drilling activity in Lebanon's waters will lead to the extraction of gas. We are here on the Lebanese southern coast facing Block 9, which includes the Qana field, prospective gas-rich field where Total Energies is expected to begin drilling this summer. And although it might be a while until the country sees any tangible revenues, many believe it could be the only life buoy for a drowning economy. According to the schedule, the program will continue for over a year, and that they're now waiting for the arrival of a rig that's needed for the drilling operation.
We are very serious about the need to drill as soon as possible and find out if indeed all the hopes and the positive assessments that we heard from and opinions that we heard from the CEOs of Eni and of Total, that indeed we have a promising field in Qana and that we will indeed have a discovery toward the end of the year. That's our hope.
As officials are working out the logistics for the foreign companies, observers remain worried over a potential intervention by the United States, which has placed many sanctions impacting Lebanon in recent years.
It's about time for the Americans to stop hindering the companies. And also it's about time for the Lebanese government in order to stand still and insist on Lebanese extraction of the oil and the gas.
This place could have been a confrontation ground. Instead, it is witnessing unprecedented tranquility. The 64-year-old Jamal Hamzi is a retired school principal who now spends most of his time in his garden. Like many in the southern border town of Naqoura, he believes that this is all due to the fact that the resistance has deterred the Israeli regime from threatening the area.
Lebanon should be able to drill its gas resources before Israel can start drilling operation in the Karish field. That was the equation that Sayed Hassan Nasrallah raised, and if it weren't for this equation, then we could not talk about drilling in Block 9 or achieve the victories we have had.
The resistance is the only hope we have to be able to restore our rights to our oil and gas resources. We were able to get the maritime deal thanks to the power of the resistance.
Total Energies has stressed that the maritime deal between Lebanon and the Israeli regime ended a deadlock over exploration activities. But some in Lebanon believe Hezbollah might need another round of UAV operations to get the drilling operation on track. Maryam Saleh, Naqoura, South Lebanon.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Mm-hmm.
and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. One of the news items making the headlines of Western mainstream media outlets is that China is increasing its military budget by 7.2%. What these corporate-owned stations fail to report is that even with this increase in its defense budget, China is still spending just over one-fourth of what the United States spends. China has the second-largest defense budget in the world after the U.S. Meanwhile, Washington is warning Beijing about supporting Russia in its war against Ukraine. China's foreign minister has responded by saying, "It's plain for the world to see who is calling for dialogue and striving for peace and who is adding fuel to the fire, handing out knives and instigating hostility." How dangerous is this scenario? Well, stay with us to find out all of this on this spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. William Jones from Executive Intelligence Review out of Washington, D.C. And John Ross, Senior Fellow, Chongyang Institute for Financial Studies out of London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start it off with William in Washington, D.C. Now, China has said that the reason it's increasing its defense budget is because of the escalating threats from abroad. Your assessment of this reason, is that true? And what does it all mean, really, in this this race for this military increase globally?
Well, I think it's absolutely the case. If you look at what the United States has been doing in its provocation, trying to create new alliances, partially of a military character in the Asia Pacific with Japan and Australia, continual and increased incursions into Taiwan Straits and the South China Sea, making a lot of trouble for China in that region, and also the general attempt to strangle China technologically by all the restrictions that are put on high technology products like semiconductors. This is a very hostile policy being imposed by the biggest military power in the world, which has a group of alliances in the so-called Western Alliance system that they have brought to bear in terms of putting pressure on China. So obviously, China, which is concerned for its own defense of its own borders, of its own region, has increased its defense budget. It's not as dramatic as the United States. The United States' increase in its defense budget, I believe, was 13% as compared to the 7% of the Chinese budget. But, of course, the United States is involved in a major war in Europe. China is just trying to defend itself. So that puts that in a much different context. But there is concern because the world situation is very turbulent and very uncertain. This has been made very clear by the Chinese president. And they're kind of, what I say, girding their loins. If any trouble would come, they would be prepared to meet that.
Well, John, if you agree with William, with his assessment just now, why do you think that the United States is getting more aggressive towards China?
Well, because it's losing in peaceful economic competition. The United States claims its economy is dynamic, etc., but the real reality is that it's losing in the competition to China. I mean, if we take the situation during the pandemic, since the beginning of the pandemic, in the 3 years of the pandemic, China's economy grew 2.5 times as fast as the United States. China grew over 13%, the US just over 5%. If you take the addition to world GDP in this period, it's 36% to China and about 16% to the United States. Then if you look at the individual companies, the US can't compete in telecommunications with Huawei. TikTok has become the most popular, so therefore the US is trying to ban Huawei. TikTok has become the most visited website in the world, so the US is now considering banning TikTok. Hikvision is the best producer of cameras for surveillance, etc. I mean, for safety surveillance in the world. So the US can't compete with that. The US admits that the whole solar power industry is totally dominated by China. The US is losing in peaceful economic competition. The only place in which it maintains a lead is military, because it spends more than the next 9 countries in the world put together. So therefore, increasingly tends to try to put things on a military terrain. And this is very, very dangerous, because the world wants to get on with peaceful development, but the US wants to move things more and more towards military actions.
Well, William, you just heard what John said. So, I mean, if it's the case that the United States cannot compete, but what they can compete in is with their military, I mean, why wouldn't Washington change its focus? I mean, it was once actually a technologically advanced country. It was the main producer of goods at one point in a time in the world. So wouldn't it make sense for the United States to actually reinvest in the country to actually get it to be more competitive technologically instead of war? I mean, how do you see it?
Well, this would be the rational response to that. The United States, of course, through its own fault, through decisions that have been made over the past decades, has transformed itself from a major industrial power to what I would call a rentier power. They have the power of the dollar. So instead of producing steel or other products in Pennsylvania, they shut that down and moved to cheap labor countries that can produce it more cheaply. And this has led to the deindustrialization of the United States. And if you look at our infrastructure, not to speak of the most dramatic example of our infrastructure, was the explosion, the train derailment in Ohio, is an indication of where the United States stands. So everybody is aware of the fact that the U.S. economy has really moved, not only in comparison to China, but in comparison to what it once was, from a major power to a economically to a really a second-rate power. And there is an understanding that there should be this infrastructure development, but it's happening in the context of this competition with China, which is making it impossible for them politically to get people together to move toward a program of a revitalization of the U.S. economy, which would create a little more confidence and a little less warlike bearing on the part of our politicians, who, as John Ross indicated, are really frightened that they've become a secondary power. But the United States policymakers are not thinking rationally in this respect. They had an opportunity also, even with China's Belt and Road initiative, that was also offered to the United States. They were prepared to help build high-speed rail in the U.S., and that was rejected because it was China doing it and not the United States doing. So it's their own folly which has led them to a policy which is restrictive, is punitive, and could lead to war rather than a policy of trying to rebuild the economic potential of the United States. And that's put the world in a real dilemma at this point.
Well, John, we know the U.S. is deeply involved with the Ukraine Russia war. Could Washington possibly want to open another front as far as dealing with a military conflict? We understand that its military spending is number one in the world, but one would think that it would be extremely stretched and foolish to want to take on China head on. What do you think?
Well, yes, if if you look at the situation statically, it would be very foolish for it. You know, it's already got one very serious war going on, you know, with Ukraine, and one very powerful enemy, which is Russia. It seems stupid to create a second one. But the problem for the United States is time. It's not capable of rebuilding itself quickly, and as the more that time goes on, the stronger China's economy will become, and the more China will lead. And Russia is a much tougher opponent than the United States envisaged. I think that the United States thought when it went in for expanding NATO into Eastern Europe, which is what is really behind the war in Ukraine, that Russia would just accept this, roll over and say, oh, well, you know, you can advance your military alliance up to our borders and we're not going to do anything.
Well, John, sorry to interrupt you here. You just said something really interesting, that the United States thought that Russia would accept them expanding east. I mean, they have so many different think tanks and institutes and universities that actually study very strategic issues. Why would they think that that major threat, even to the existence of Russia, that Moscow would not have to actually defend itself to the end?
Well, because they have a rather arrogant and ignorant it's a combination of the two. They don't think they need to know the world. Everybody knows that if you look at the situation of Russia, Russia's history is that it's been constantly attacked by forces from Western Europe, or basing themselves in Western Europe. It was attacked by Napoleon, it was attacked by Hitler, and now it's got the expansion of NATO. It has always defended itself. Anybody who takes a quick look at history, you know, go and read War and Peace, and you'll find out or go read any history of World War II, and you'll find that Russia will defend itself. The United States made the calculation that Russia wouldn't defend itself, and this has then led to a very major war. Now the United States hopes that the effects of this war will be to weaken Russia. It hopes to overthrow Putin. This, unfortunately for them, all the polls show that the war is supported by the big majority of the population of Russia because it sees it as a defensive war. There is no opposition to Putin which is pro-Western of any significance. The only major opposition to Putin, only major force in Russia which is independent of Putin is the Communist Party, and they support the war. So there's no chances of this political disintegration, and the United States has therefore got itself into a great mess in which by now, tens of thousands, more probably hundreds of thousands Ukrainians are dying. And the United States is hoping that the U.S. population will continue to pay for this and not accept it, although it's attacking the living standards. Okay, well, that's a calculation. But they don't, you know, anybody who studies Russian history knows that Russia will fight ferociously in order to defend itself. Right. And that's exactly what it's doing. And the United States has made a big miscalculation.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
What do you think about how the United States is dealing with both Russia and China because it's sanctioned both? I mean, aren't they not just driving these two powers closer together? And isn't that not to the benefit of Washington in the long run?
Well, it definitely is a driving them closer. And it certainly, if it came to a conflict with China as well, it would be a serious situation for the United States in conducting this kind of war, even with their so-called alliances. But on the Ukraine situation, you've got to understand that The United States had a policy, and we go back to the writings of Zbigniew Brzezinski, that if they could pull Ukraine away from Russia, Russia would become a second-rate power because they would leave, they would lose southern Russia, they would lose Crimea, etc. All of these things would go by the board, and they felt that that Russia would thereby be manageable, as it was to some extent under President Yeltsin, and that therefore they're playing a very dangerous game in Ukraine, where the Ukrainian people, unfortunately, are the casualties of a Western policy that is possibly leading us to nuclear war. This is a lack of understanding of Russia and basically a lack of understanding of the importance of Russia in the world economy. And the Europeans are suffering that, the United States less, because they're selling more to Europe, which can no longer buy Russian oil, and so they're profiting from it as well. But the world generally is suffering. The ones who are suffering the most are the Ukrainian people, who are subject to a government which has been under the heel of NATO and of the United States political establishment at least since 2014 and even before, when they manipulated the change of government.
Well, John, is the United States trying to do the same thing now with the situation in China, dealing with Taiwan? We've seen more and more American politicians go to Taiwan, and again, just like Russia had warned the United States about its red line, China has also warned the United States about its red line in dealing with Taiwan.
Yes, certainly the United States is playing with fire over the question of Taiwan. I mean, I always use the analogy for the United States. They should be able to understand it, the United States, very clearly. Who is generally regarded as the greatest president in the history of the United States? It's Abraham Lincoln. If you look at Abraham Lincoln objectively, what did he do? He crushed the separatists, that is the Confederacy, and he said, we're not going to have the United States split up, and if I have to go to war, which he then proceeded to do. And he is, we might call him, you know, Abraham Lincoln, great struggler against separatism. So the United States should be able to understand this. This is the same exactly with the question of Taiwan, apart from the fact when the Japanese stole Taiwan from China by aggression at the end of the 19th century. Taiwan has always been part of China. Incidentally, not even the government of Taiwan denies that it's part of China. The so-called government in Taipei, it declares that there's one China. Mainland China says there's one China. One thing they're all agreed with, there's one China, except that the United States wants to play with the separatism, and do not. And the response of China will be equally as fierce as was Abraham Lincoln's, and it'll be as equally as fierce as did Russia's in the Ukraine. So the United States is really playing with fire over this issue, and I really, really hope that more sane heads may prevail, although given the present state in the United States, unfortunately, one can't be sure.
Yeah, indeed. Well, William, when we look at the now threats of increased sanctions against China, we know the economic relationship between China and the United States. Is this also something that can backfire against Washington itself if it continues to sanction China? Now, China is talking about actually the way the United States is trying to control competition and targeting foreign countries. Your take on that?
Well, it already has affected the United States, I think, in terms of much of the trade. That the U.S. would be in a better position today if they had maintained trade with China. They'd probably be able to rebuild the economy much more than they've been able to do in the last few years. But the fact China's role in the world economy is such at this point that there is no possibility of a full decoupling unless you want to go back to a new dark ages for most of the world. And that's not going to change. That's a dynamic that cannot be controlled by government. What government is trying to do, therefore, is to restrict the input of high technology into China, which I think is a foolish endeavor. China has now a middle class, and John can correct me, about 400 million people. These people are being focused at this latest National People's Congress on development of science and technology. The budget is increasing. The budget of basic scientific research is increasing, and you have a lot of smart people there. And smart people create new ideas, and the new ideas creates the new technology. So China may be hampered to some extent by the attempt by the U.S. and its allies, to the extent they want to go along with it. Some of them won't, to try and restrict technologies. They will develop it on their own. It may take them just a little longer, but they will do it. This is not a smart move to be made. And the question is whether the United States can, in fact, make the kind of investment under present economic conditions, including inflation, in high technology to really even get back on its feet. It may make some gains in semiconductors, but look at all the other spheres of activity in AI, in quantum computing, and all this other these other elements of the new technologies that they really haven't been doing enough investing in. The question is, will they be able to do it at the same time that they're putting these restrictions on China? I think it's not going to happen.
Well, John, I'd like to hear your short-term and long-term forecasts of where you see this going, China-U.S. relations.
Well, I think in the short term, we're going through, well, I'm using the short term in relative sense. Let's say the next 5 to 10 years. I think we're going through a very dangerous situation because the United States can't compete economically, as I outlined, and therefore it's increasingly tempted to either direct military means or indirect military means. These can be proxy wars, as in the Ukraine. They can be attempt to destabilize countries. They can be putting pressure on countries to try to break off trade relations, all sorts of things. But the logic of the United States is, as it's losing economically, it keeps proclaiming how wonderful its economy is, but actually it's being outcompeted by China, that it will resort to military means. And this is a very dangerous situation. And that this is why, undoubtedly, China has to threat from the United States. I mean, if you look at United States military policy, it's been attempting to create a first strike nuclear capacity, and this is extremely dangerous. Over the longer run, China will become so strong, both technologically and economically, that the US won't be able to deal with it. China's R&D expenditure is already about the same level as the United States in absolute terms. It's been growing at 11% a year and the US at 4% a year. So by 2030, China will be considerably outspending the United States in R&D. China's got a project of doubling the size of its economy by 2035, which is its next key target. This will make it a much bigger economy than the United States. And I hope that the United States will then adjust down around to accepting this new reality. It's a terrible shock that a non-Christian, non-white, other country than the United States will be the largest economy in the world. But, you know, that's the situation that we're going to be in. So I hope after a period of time, the United States will just settle down to accepting this and not try to be threatening the situation. But I think we're going through, let's say, a very dangerous decade.
Okay. And on that note, it brings us to the end of the show. I appreciate both of you being with me. William Jones from the Executive Intelligence Review out of Washington, D.C. John Ross, Senior Fellow of Chongyang Institute for Financial Studies out of London. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. Goodbye for now.